An Osho Talk. From Unconsciousness to Consciousness, number 22.
You say there is no God. Can you explain why man has ventured into the spiritual realm in search of God?
Existence as such has no meaning. Neither it is meaningless. Meaning is simply irrelevant to existence. There is no goal existence is trying to achieve. There is no where it is going. It simply is. Meaning is goal-oriented, some purpose, some achievement. Man's mind brings the problem of meaning. And the mind is the root cause of all the questions that arise in you. The mind cannot rest at ease with things as they are. It is the nature of mind. The oceans are not worried about God. The mountains are not contemplating about God. The trees are not thinking about God. Look at from a different angle. A ship drowns in the ocean. Is the ocean moral or immoral? The very question is irrelevant. The ocean is not doing it purposefully. There is no motivation. It is not gaining anything out of it. It was not after doing it. If it had not happened, the ocean would not have been in despair. If it has happened, the ocean is not going to celebrate the victory. In fact, for the ocean, the very existence of the ship is not in any way a concern. So the accident of the ship drowning is neither moral on the part of the ocean nor immoral. It is amoral. Morality is man's mind game. Existence knows nothing of it. Animals know nothing of it. The birds are not aware of it. It is only man. And man is different from the whole existence because of the mind. It gives him a totally new dimension. The mind asks why existence is there at all. Who created it? Why he created it? There must be some purpose behind it. Because mind cannot conceive anything which has no purpose. Mind is very Jewish. It thinks in terms of business. What you are going to get out of it? If you are not going to get anything out of it, then why you are doing it? You cannot say, just for its own sake, then you are mad, crazy. I am reminded, somebody asked Picasso, he was painting by the beach near the ocean, something. A man was standing there looking. He could not figure it out what it is. In fact, it is very difficult to figure out Picasso's paintings. And that is the genius of the man, that he has brought his paintings to the status of existence. They are existential. You cannot ask their meaning, their purpose, what they are. But the man was perfectly right. He asked, I have been waiting, watching. What are you doing? What is this? What is this painting? Picasso looked at him and he said, I know you have been waiting, watching, and I was worried that you are going to ask this question. I don't know. I myself don't know what it is. And I don't care to know. Nobody asks the flowers what you are, why you are, why you are red, why you are blue, why you are yellow. Why this shape and not another shape? And why this season, not another season? And why this perfume, not another perfume? Nobody asks the flowers. Nobody asks the clouds where you are moving. What is the purpose of all this activity? Nobody asks the stars. The whole existence is continuously active. Everything is moving. Nothing is static. Nobody asks why people go on torturing a poor painter. I just enjoyed doing it. Is that not enough? I'm immensely happy that it has happened. I don't know what it is. The man simply thought he's mad. But painters are forgiven. People don't expect them to be sane at all. Poets are forgiven. You know that they are a little bit crazy, otherwise who bothers about painting and poetry when there are so many things to do in the world, to earn mountains of money, to be presidents and prime ministers, kings and queens. And these fools are wasting their time, their life. And if you ask them for what, they don't even have the answer. The man simply moved. He said, I knew it, that you don't know what you are doing. No madman knows what he is doing. Picasso laughed and he said, that's right. I would rather prefer to be a madman than to be a reasonable, rational businessman. I want to be part of this existence. Mind is part of the society. It is not part of existence. Hence, it needs a society for its growth. The better established society, the mind grows more proficiently. The question of God arose because in the very beginning, perhaps 10,000 years before, because in the Rig Veda, the oldest scripture in the world, one of the most important statement occurs, and that statement is, we do not know who created the world. We do not know whether anybody created it or not. This must be in the very beginning that man starts the first stirrings of thought. Who created the world? We do not know. Yes, the theologian has not appeared yet. The man with the answer has not appeared yet. He comes very soon. He is not far away. Once you ask, we do not know who created the world, the cunning man amongst you will come with the answer. He will say, you don't know, I know. And immediately he becomes your superior. He becomes the wise man, the priest, the rabbi, the Messiah. Because he knows and you don't know. This statement in the Rig Vedas, later on, priests condemned it by entitling it Nasadi Sutra. It means negative sutras. The title must have been given by those people who are pretending that they know. But the people who must have raised those sutras, those questions, were more innocent. They were simply saying, we do not know. And there seems to be no way to know. Who created it all? And whether anybody created it at all? It may have existed forever. Is there any necessity that there should be a beginning and an end? Yes, in a human story, you have a beginning and an end. In a movie, you have a beginning and an end. But in existence, there is no beginning, no end. But the mind cannot conceive that there is no beginning. The mind can conceive, you can take it as far back as possible, millions of light years back, it can conceive. But it cannot conceive that it is a beginningless universe. Mind feels some intrinsic incapacity to conceive the beginninglessness and endlessness. That is the truth. But mind wants the answer, who began it all? And to satisfy the mind, otherwise it goes crazy, asking these questions, finding no answer, it becomes more and more desperate. It becomes a constant anguish. Because if we don't know the meaning of our lives, then thousand other questions arise. Then why we go on living? If we are just accidental, without any purpose, we happen one day, and one day we disappear, leaving not even a trace behind. The mind is not capable of it. It wants to create history. It wants to leave its name behind. It makes pyramids which will last for thousands of years. It makes monuments. Even ordinary people in Jabalpur, where I lived for many years, there is one of the most beautiful spots possible. One of the most beautiful rivers of India, Narmada, passes for almost 2 miles between two mountains of marble, pure white mountains of marble, for 2 miles on both the sides, mountains of marble. And you can see their shadow in the river. And in a full moon night, it becomes absolutely a dreamland. You cannot believe it. When I took one of my professors, Dr. S. K. Saxena, because I was talking again and again to him that one day you have to come with me, finally he said, I don't believe that something can be dream-like. But if you insist, I will take the chance. He used to live 120 miles away from Jabalpur. So I took him on a full moon night to the marble rocks. And the moment we entered into the Narmada, he looked here and there. In the beginning, for half a mile, it is just ordinary river. After half a mile, suddenly you enter into the marble world. He could not believe. He said to me that, forgive me that I doubted you. Take me close to the mountains because I want to touch and see whether they are there or there is some trick, some magic. It is really dreamlike, but I want to touch and see that it is real, not just a dream. Not that you have brought me into some magical world. I had to take the boat close to the mountains. He touched the mountains, felt the mountains, took a small rock with him. I said, "What you are doing?" He said, "I will carry it to remember that it was not a dream. This rock will remind me that it was a reality. Otherwise, in the morning, I may start suspecting it is unbelievably true." But if you ask for the meaning, there is none. If you ask for the purpose, there is none. It is utterly beautiful. Just pure beauty. But bring the mind in and immediately the question, why? And the mind wants first to know why. Where? By whom? For what purpose? So the first rising of mind in human beings, you can conceive what they had faced. The sky full of stars. Just think of yourself as Adam and Eve, the first man and woman on the earth. To you it does not create any question because you don't even see at the stars. You have become accustomed. You take them for granted. But the first glimmerings, strings of intelligence in man, all was a fairyland. Everything was a question mark. So many stars. Why? Who created them? So many trees. So many flowers. Who goes on painting them? The sunrise, the sunset. Everything was thrilling, ecstatic. And all the questions became one question, and that question is God. God is not a simple question. All these questions of purpose, meaning, motive, beginning, end, the cunning priest exploited the situation of the simple human mind. He said, you don't know, but I know. God is the invention of those cunning people. God created it. And then they started figuring out about God, because people started asking, who is this God, where he lives, why he created. So they had to invent God is omnipotent, all-powerful. He can do anything. Just the other day I received a letter. I am receiving many letters from Christians. This poor fellow says that you don't know miracles happen. I have seen it happen. They have happened to me. My truck was stuck in the mud. And I tried everything that I could do, but it won't budge. Then I prayed to God, and suddenly the miracle. The truck moved. And you say, there are no miracles. Now this poor fellow thinks that God is so much interested in him and his truck, which is stuck in the mud, that when he prays, he immediately runs as if he is a mechanic. Prayer is a phone call. He runs immediately, fixes it, and the truck is on the road. And you say that there are no miracles. And all these Christians have been relating their experience of miracles, which are just like this. Man's ego finds it very satisfying that even God cares about you, knows about you, even about your truck stuck in the mud. But he is not aware that what he is saying, it has nothing to do with God, it has something to do with the ego. The cunning priest played the game, fulfilling your ego, answering your questions raised by the mind in such a way that one thing can do both the with one stone, he killed two birds. The answer was a fulfillment for the ego and a fulfillment for the mind. If it was not fulfilling to your ego, you would have rejected. You would have doubted. You would have raised 1001 questions. But it was very fulfilling to the ego to doubt means your fulfillment for the ego disappears. It is better to drop doubting. It is far more profitable. Your ego is fulfilled. God creates the world. He is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. He knows everything. Past, present, future. Unless he knows everything, he will not know you and your truck is stuck in the mud in Oregon. And can you conceive the idea of the mind and the ego and their games? Up to now, they have counted at least 2 million galaxies. Our sun, our moon, our earth, all the planets, and all the stars that you see with your bare eyes is one galaxy. This sun is the center of this galaxy. Everything is moving around the sun. The sun is the center of one galaxy. It is one solar system. At least 2 million solar systems have been discovered. Many more are there. One can be certain about it because we have not come to the end of the world and we are not going to come to the end. The mind cannot conceive. Mind always thinks somewhere there must be an end. When Columbus was trying, persuading people because nobody was going with him, there was nobody ready. It was one crazy queen of Spain who said, I will give the money, you try. It was not a problem for her. Money was simple for her. And she was known for crazy things. And this idea struck her that it is perfectly good, even if you are lost. You are lost. You are asking it for yourself. I will pay for the trip. But you find the man, he needed at least 90 persons to go with him, to take care of the ship, food, everything, because he estimated it will take at least 3 months to come back home. To have a round trip and come back home, it will take at least 3 months. That was his calculation, which was wrong, proved wrong. But because the queen was helping, few daring people, courageous people, started being ready to go with him, and one day, with 90 people, he started. The Pope sent him the last warning that I tell you, don't do such a stupid thing. You will repent forever. Because it says in the Bible, the earth is flat. So one day, you will come to the very end of the earth and your ship will go down from the very edge of the earth where you are going to be. You will fall into eternal hell. There is bound to be an end. You cannot go on forever, forever. And earth is flat. So there is an age and you are going to fall in with you with these 90 fools who are going. They are going to fall. I am giving you the last warning. Don't go against God. But Copernicus, Columbus, Galileo, these people are not gullible. They are not the mediocre mass which the priest can exploit. Columbus said, I am going. It is better to fall from the edge, but at least I will see with my own eyes the edge of the earth, the flatness of the earth. And I will see what happens after the fall. Where we land up. Whether we land up anywhere or we go on falling, we will see. But as days started passing, weeks, months, the 90 people who were with him started becoming afraid. Only 3 days more and their ration will be finished. They have traveled 2 months, 27 days. And he had promised that in 3 months we will be back home. There seems to be no sign anywhere. They all gathered in the night when Columbus was sleeping to kill him. And went back, because alive he is not going to go back. He is not the man to go back. He would rather fall into the eternal ditch. He is not the man to go back. Even to say anything about it is impossible. But Columbus was suspecting that these people must be getting afraid. He himself was getting doubts. 3 months are ending. There is no sign. Neither the home nor the age, nothing has happened. And there seems to be this ocean going on and on. So when he saw that all the 90 people have gathered, he pretended to sleep. He was not sleeping. He went to listen. They had closed the door. He listened. They were trying that we throw him into the ocean and we go back. This is the only way. Otherwise, we are finished. He is finished. We are finished. He is finished because of his own stubbornness. We are unnecessarily finished. Columbus knocked on the door. They became afraid. They opened the door, saw Columbus. Columbus entered in. He said, "You are perfectly right. There is no need to conspire. You can throw me into the ocean. But listen to one thing. You have only for 3 days ration. If you go back, at least you need for 2 months 27 days ration. 3 days won't help. After 3 days, what you will do? In 3 days, you will reach home. That much is absolutely certain. My calculations may have gone wrong. But this calculation you can do yourself, that we have come 2 months, 27 days. Now going back will also take the same time. If you don't drift here and by, if you don't lose the track, if you go exactly backwards, which is not certain, then too you need that much ration. You don't have that much ration. And you will have one person less, Columbus. You idiots. Listen to me. It is better to go ahead. Perhaps in 3 days we may reach. Because going ahead is open. We may reach, we may not reach, but there is a possibility we may reach. And I have absolute certainty that we will reach, because I have seen today a bird flying in the sky, and I have seen few leaves flying, flowing into the ocean. So we are very close to the earth. We may not reach our home, but we are going to reach some place. The logic was absolutely clear. Even those idiots could understand that that's true. Backwards, it is absolute death. After 3 days, you will start starving. And without the intelligence of Columbus, ahead, there is a possibility. He may still prove right. 3 days are still left. They changed their plan. They asked to be forgiven. Columbus said, "No problem. I myself doubt many times that what I have done, I am not concerned about me. I am concerned about you, because it is not your project, it is my project, and you are unnecessarily being sacrificed to it. But wait 3 days more. Give me my 3 months completely." And in 3 days he reached America. He did not reach back home. He did not reach India. That was his second thought, that if they don't reach back to Spain, then they may reach half the way at least to India from the other side, because from one side the traffic was open between Spain and India, between England and India, the traffic was open. So at least from the other side we may reach India. And he thought that this is India. That's why the people who are living here were living here, to whom this country belongs, are called Red Indians. That is not their name, it is Columbus' name given to them. They were of red color, reddish, and he thought it is India, so he called them Red Indians. The priest did two things. He satisfied your mind, put it into a coma. There is God. And He knows all. And He has created everything. And when all-knowing, all-powerful, all over-present, God is there, you need not worry about the purpose. He will take care. He has already taken care. He has created man as the supreme most creation to rule over the whole world of animals, mountains, oceans, trees. He has created man in his own image. Just think of that statement. God has created man in his own image. The priest is fulfilling both the things. He is saying that you are created by God in his own image. You partake something of God's. You are his inheritors. It helped, consoled, took away the worry, anxiety, fear. You have somebody so powerful, so all-knowing, and everywhere present, so there is no need to be worried that whether in time of trouble you call and he is gone somewhere else. He is present everywhere. So you can pray and he is listening. And he is all powerful, so don't suspect that he will not do it. He can do anything. So you can ask for anything. If you ask with total faith, you see the trick. These are the tricks that the priest has played over the whole history of man, with total trust. Now, trust can never be total. Doubtless belief. Now, belief can never be without doubt. So, he is giving you conditions to fulfill, that if your prayer is not fulfilled, you will know why it is not fulfilled. Not that God is not there to listen. Not that he is deaf. Not that he is no more concerned about you. Not that he has retired or died. No, your belief is not absolute. You are having doubt by the side, around the corner, and you know the doubt. So you are at fault. And once in a while, when the truck moves out of the mud, then it is so gratifying to think that in 2 million galaxies, 2 million suns, and each sun having millions of stars, hundreds of planets, your tiny earth, it is a very tiny earth. This sun is 60,000 times bigger than the earth. And this sun is a very mediocre sun. It is not the biggest sun. Just in the middle range. There are suns which are thousands times bigger than this. So this is small earth. And on this small earth, this is small America. And in this small America, this is small Oregon. And in the small Oregon, the big muddy ranch. And your great truck caught into mud. And he comes running. It is so gratifying. So once in a while, if you go on praying, once in a while you will find that your prayer has been heard. Then it is gratifying. Then you completely forget that there was still doubt. No, when things are gratifying, who bothers about such uncomfortable, inconvenient truths? No, one completely forgets. One is so overjoyed in one's belief. And one satisfies also that his belief is so powerful that God has to listen it. Now these fools write to me in their letters that they are praying for me to God that God should forgive me. They should pray to me that I should forgive their God. Because he has tortured humanity enough. He and his company of messiahs, avatars, tirthankaras, paigambaras, this whole lot. And the priests all over the earth have been sucking blood of humanity. They should pray to me that I should forgive their God and their messiahs and their tirthankaras and their avataras. But they are asking that I should be forgiven because I don't know that miracles are there, that I don't know, that Jesus is the true Messiah, that He is really the only begotten Son of God. They are praying for me. At least a dozen letters every day that we will pray in the church to Jesus, to God, that you should be forgiven. There is no God. Even if I want to forgive him, it is pointless. There is no God whom I can forgive. And I cannot forgive the company that has used the name of God and exploited the whole humanity up to now. I cannot forgive. Nor I can forget. Because this company is the worst gang of criminals possible. They have used your weakness. The mind's weakness is it wants certain support for meaning. They gave it a false support. A promise which is not going to be fulfilled. And they fulfilled the ego, which is one of the greatest barriers in knowing existence. So both the ways they have committed such a crime that it is incalculable. On the one hand, they stop the mind from getting into the quest because they supplied ready-made answers. A true religion will say your question is valid. Go on searching. And there is no answer which can be given by anybody to you. Any answer given by anybody to you is a wrong answer. Remember it. It is not a question whether it is right or wrong. If it is given by somebody else, the very fact that it is given by somebody else to you, not found by you, it is false. You have to find it yourself, and you have to risk everything to find it. The question is valid, the answer is wrong. So in the Rig Vedas, the statement, we do not know. Why this existence? Who created it? Whether there is anybody who created it at all? It's the only authentic statement in the whole Rig Veda which the priests call the negative sutra. They think some atheist, because Rig Veda is not a book written by one man. It is a collection. Hundreds of poets, seers, scholars have contributed to it. It is almost like Encyclopedia Britannica. The four Vedas contain all the knowledge of those days, 10,000 years before, whatsoever was known, whatsoever questions were raised. It contains all. It is really an encyclopedia. It should be put with the encyclopedias, not a holy book. There is no holy book at all. Just as the Jews and Christians are very much worried about the Song of Solomon in the Old Testament, they would have loved that it was not there. But what they can do, it is there. And now it is too late to take it out. And they are really ashamed. No rabbi comments on it. No Christian priest comments on it. And it is the only beautiful piece in the whole Bible. But because it is a song of love, and Solomon is singing in the praise of his beloved, it is very sensuous. I don't think any poet has ever come closer to the Song of Solomon in sensuousness. Your D.H. Lawrence, Henry Miller, and others have much to learn from the Song of Solomon. But Jews go on hiding it, Christians go on hiding it. If you simply go to the church, you will never know that there is something like Song of Solomon. No rabbi is going to comment on it. He will feel ashamed. Because Solomon is so authentic about his feelings, emotions, sensuality, that it seems he knows Sigmund Freud perfectly well. That Sigmund Freud may have to learn something from Solomon. Solomon need not bother about Sigmund Freud. You will be surprised that the Song of Solomon is a Jewish and Christian phenomenon. But in India, Solomon is called Suleiman, that is the Indian pronunciation for Solomon. And in India there is a proverb, if somebody tries to be very wise, he said, don't try to be a Suleiman. Don't pretend to be a Solomon. Don't pretend to be so wise as Solomon was. Now, in India, that proverb is very ancient. But India can accept Solomon because it can accept Khajuraho. Solomon's songs should be engraved in the temples of Khajuraho. Only there it is befitting. Where a stone has been turned into such sensuous beauty, the thousands of women and men which are sculptured look so real. You would like to hug them. You will feel ashamed that why you are not so beautiful, so proportionate. Solomon's song will be perfectly the right book for the temples of Khajuraho, Konark, Puri. And in India, this is one of the ancient proverbs. Don't try to be a Suleiman. But Jews and Christians don't accept Solomon to be a wise man. He seems to be the only other wise man in the whole Bible. The same is the situation of the Nasadi Sutra in Rig Veda. To me, that is the only sutra which is authentic. Anybody who wrote 10,000 years before, we do not know. We only have questions. We don't have any answers. Must have been a man of tremendous courage. And this courage is needed to search, to seek, and to find. But you will not find God. You will find yourself. You will not find the Creator, but you will find the creative energy that surrounds you within and without. If you listen to others, it is God the Creator. If you search on your own, then it is godliness, the creativity. Once the priest started answering that there is God, then people started asking about God. They forgot why they had asked in the first place for God. Who created the world? The priests answered, God. And in every country, the priest was free to imagine what God is, how he looks. The Chinese God looks like a Chinese. He cannot have a beard like me. Chinese cannot afford my beard. That is impossible. They have just a small beard. Hairs you can count on your fingers. The Chinese god also have the same beard. When one Chinese friend has brought to me a statue of Chinese god, I told him, you could have been a little generous at least with your god. What kind of beard? Just 12 hairs on it? And a flat nose. And both the cheeks bones standing out. It has to be Chinese. The Hindu god has to be Hindu. I was telling you about Khajuraho. If you see those women, they are Hindu women, and not of today, but of those days when those women were carved. Women must have modeled, otherwise you cannot have all that proportion. You will not find such round breasts anywhere in the world as you will find in the Khajuraho statues. But Indian women used to have that kind of breast. Unless a woman had that kind of breast, full grown, full round, she was not beautiful. And she was missing something. She cannot be a true mother. Of course, little kids would have been in trouble with those breasts. That I can understand. When I was visiting, and I was visiting again and again Khajuraho, because it was one of the tremendous phenomenon, those 30 temples. I asked the guide, who finally became a sannyasin. He is now a sannyasin, the guide who is in Khajuraho. I asked him that if the breast is so round, then it will be very difficult for the child to drink milk out of it. His nose will go into the breast. He will choke. He will not be... Because mouth he is drinking, nose will be closed. He will die. He said, you are a strange man. I have been here for 30 years. Thousands of people, I have sown these temples, but nobody bothered about. Not even I myself have thought, it is true. I said, you can try. He said, there is no need to try. It is absolutely true. Such a round breast. The nose is bound to be stopped, and the child cannot breathe. It would have been really difficult for the kids. But I have looked in the ancient most scriptures of India. The breast is depicted by Kalidas, Bhavbhuti, by all the great poets in the same way. In the West, the breast is disappearing. In the East also, it is no more the same. Something has gone wrong somewhere. Something has changed. In the West, the woman is trying to be equal to man in every possible way. Her psychology is different now. She wants to wear the same clothes as men. Naturally, her body is changing its shape with the clothes, with the psychology, with her desire. Her body is changing. Her breasts and her bottoms both are disappearing. She is becoming a straight pillar. With no ups, no downs. That is ugly. But unless she stops the idea of becoming like man, the body follows the mind. It is slowly, slowly fits to the idea of the mind. I have been a guest in tribes, very ancient tribes, where the woman is stronger than the man. For the first time, when you see the fact, you cannot believe it. All over the world, the man is taller, is stronger, muscular, the woman is smaller, not muscular. But in these tribes in Central India, the woman is taller, the woman has muscles, the woman does all kinds of work. The man takes care of the children. Naturally, he has shrunken. He is no more the same man because he is not using his muscles. He has become wife. The wife become husband. Once your psychology changes, and why it happened in Central India, because the man found it easier. You can marry as many women as you want. So man started marrying many women, and he started putting them to use, to work. Go to the farm, go to the orchard, go to the river, go to the well to bring water. What all these women should do sitting in the house? He started resting and the women started working. And of course, when women are working, they will leave the children with the husband that just watch over the children, take care of them. Slowly, slowly, the woman became taller, stronger. Now the situation is, the man cannot beat the woman in Central India. The woman beats the man. And it is accepted. Just as in other parts of India, if a man hits the wife, it is accepted. He need not even ask an apology. It is his right. The same is true in Central India. The wife can beat the husband. It is her right. If he has not been taking care of the children well, he is going to be punished. All over the world, the woman has remained small because man has been imposing the psychology that I am bigger, stronger, I am your caretaker, your safety, your security. And he is making the woman weaker, because the weaker she is, the more she will be dependent on him. So don't educate her. Don't let her work. So financially she is weak. Educationally she is weak. She has to depend on you. Where she can go? What she can do? How she can earn her livelihood? It is impossible. When Bhavabhuti, Kalidas and other poets and these unknown sculptors were painting the woman, it was not imaginary, because it is not only in one place. All over India, in any temple, you will find the same statue, the same kind of statue, the same figure. It must have been common. But it started disappearing as the Mohammedans entered India. As the Mohammedans entered India, they brought women who use a veil called burqa, a black veil covering all over the body. They rarely see the sunlight. Many may not have seen the sun ever in their life. They rarely see other human beings other than their husband, their children. Their bodies are pale, are bound to be. Weak, fragile. They don't have round, big breasts. Their bodies cannot support that kind of breast. When Mohammedan women came to India, and Mohammedans are very much interested in other people's women, because they can marry four women. Their own society, they cannot find four, because the proportion always remains the same naturally. As many boys, as many girls are born. You will be surprised. Nature has a way of its own arithmetic. One 100 girls are born, then 110 boys are born. Because by the time they become mature, 10 boys would have died. Boys are kamzor, weaker. Their resistance to diseases, to sickness, is lesser than the woman's. So 100 girls and 110 boys, that is the proportion nature brings. 10 more, because 10 are going to be finished before they become marriageable. By the time they are 16, they will be of equal numbers. So it seems to be natural arrangement that one man, one woman, that should be the way. How you can get 3 other women from where? So they were grabbing anybody's woman. With them entered in India parda, ghungat. The Indian woman also started hiding herself in her sari, in her sari pulled down over the head so her face nobody can see. And she started using clothes which don't show her breasts. Otherwise, she was joyous about her body. With Mohammedans coming to India, she became afraid of her body. She became, deep down in her psychology, shrunken. To be a woman became a sin, a danger. It is from the Mohammedan period in India that the woman lost her old beauty, her old proportions. She is no more the Khajuraho woman. What I was saying is Solomon in the Old Testament is the only authentic, realistic, existential person. He is not a priest, and he is not a rabbi, and he is not a prophet. He is truly a man, a human being. And he is not ashamed of being a human being and of human qualities. The same is true about the Nasdi Sutra in Rig Veda. We don't know who wrote it, but whoever wrote it, humanity owes much to that unknown man. 10,000 years before, when everybody was trembling before the priests, and what the priests were doing were all mumbo jumbo. They were not allowing the people to read the scriptures. Because if the people read the scriptures, they will know what is written there. It is all rubbish. So the priest will repeat it, and Sanskrit is such a beautiful and poetic language that even if you are reading the daily newspaper, it will look poetry. It will look great poetry. It is so musical that listening to Sanskrit, you will forget that you need to understand what is being said. You will simply love and enjoy the chanting of it, the music of it, the rhythm of it. And that quality the priest used very cleverly. He did not allow the masses to read, so they never understand what actually is written. The masses had to talk and use other languages. Sanskrit was only for the priests, Brahmins. So they kept everybody unknown what is written there. Women was completely cut because no woman was allowed to read the holy scriptures, Vedas. The Sudras, which are 1/4 of the country, were completely prohibited that if they are found even to hear, nothing to say about reading, if some Brahmin is chanting and some Sudra hiding tries to hear it, it is enough that he can be given the ultimate punishment, death penalty. And even a man like Rama, whom Hindus worship as God's incarnation, did such an inhuman act that that single act is enough to condemn him forever. A Brahmin came to Rama with his young son who had died just now. And he said, "My son has died. And this shows that some Sudra, some untouchable, is reading somewhere in your kingdom, Vedas." Now, what is the connection if a Sudra is reading the Veda? Now, everybody can read. They are available in all the libraries and all the Sudras are reading. And no Brahmins are dying. And why this particular Brahmin's son will die if some Sudra somewhere is reading? Immediately, great search was made. It was found that one Sudra was not reading but hearing. Somebody was chanting and he was hearing because chanting was so beautiful and there was nothing wrong, but this was enough. He was called to the court and Rama ordered that molten lead should be poured into both of his ears. So he will never again hear anything. And this man is God's incarnation. And this was done. Such cruel act. And it does not help the Brahmin's son. He has died. He has not come back to life. If he had come back to life, then too there was some meaning to it. He has not come back to life. But this man is deaf for his whole life. And perhaps it may have destroyed his brain cells, his eyes, who knows. Because the scriptures don't bother to describe what happened to the man, whether he died, lived, You are pouring fire into his both the ears. And the ears are connected with the nose, connected with the eyes, connected with the brain. You may have destroyed such fragile tissues in his brain that even if he was alive, he would have been just a robot. And what was his sin? Because he has heard some Brahmin chanting a mantra, which he cannot even understand because he does not know Sanskrit. The priest tried that people should not know much about scriptures. They should not ask questions. They should not raise doubts. Their function is to believe, to pray, to worship. And they will be benefited in the coming life after death. God is the greatest lie that has been uttered. Now, I laugh because I have been few times in the courts. One time I was in a court and they said to me that take the oath in the name of God. I said, don't mention the name of God because I cannot take the oath of truth in the name of the greatest lie. The judge could not believe. He said, what are you saying? I said, I am saying God is the greatest lie. And you are telling me to take the oath of truth in the name of God? If you want that, I will do. But remember, I am taking the oath of truth in the name of lie. The truth means nothing. The oath means nothing. And you are giving me absolute freedom to lie from the very beginning. Then he said, then there are other alternatives. You can take the oath in any holy scripture you believe. I said, I don't believe in any holy scripture. I have never come across any holy scripture. Then he said, the last thing is you can take oath in the name of the Constitution of India. I said, I am not ready to take oath in the name of those scriptures which have some beautiful statements, which have some beautiful poetry, which are written by poets, seers. Some of them may have known the truth. But as a whole, I don't consider the book holy, so I am not taking the oath. Do you think I will take the oath in the name of the Constitution written by the third-class politicians, the worst people in the country? Then he said, then what? But oath has to be taken. I said, I can take oath on my own authority. That's the only way. There is no other way. All other ways are created by the priests, and I don't believe in priests. The priests have given you the greatest lie and then to protect the lie, they have to create more lies, that he punishes you, that he rewards you, that he sends special messengers to you, that whenever there is trouble, whenever there is suffering, he comes. It's strange, and people go on believing people are living in suffering and misery, and he does not seem to come, except to remove a truck. A great miracle. And people are dying. So many wars, so many people being killed. And he is not. Do you think those millions of Jews who were gassed in Germany, many of them were rabbis, very learned ones. They were not praying. He comes to move the truck in the muddy range. And what about those millions of Jews and hundreds of rabbis being gassed, and he does not come at all? What has happened in Russia? After the revolution, at least 10 million people have been killed. And not rich people, because where you can find 10 million rich people in Russia? Poor people, for whom the revolution was made, in whose name the revolution was made, in whose name the Communist Party was ruling, and they are being killed for small reasons. Those poor people, and Russia was very poor, one of the poorest countries, because the Tsar and super rich people who were surrounding the Tsar, they were exploiting the whole country so tremendously for hundreds of years that everybody was starving, dying, sick. Now a man has two hands, and you can just see, poor man has two hands, and only two hands is all that he has. So he can sell two eggs every day, some earning out of it, some earnings from somewhere else, somewhere he can work. Now the Communist Party says everything belongs to the state. These two hands are now property of the state. Now that poor man does not understand communism or anything. He understands only thing that his two hands are going. He tries hard not to give to his hands. He is being shot because he is fighting against communism. He was simply fighting for his two hands, without which he cannot live. Such poor people, millions of people are simply such. And they were all very orthodox Catholic Christians. The Russian church was the most orthodox church in the whole world. Vatican is nothing. And it was independent of Vatican. Just because of orthodoxy, it thought that Vatican is too liberal. It was absolutely orthodox. These people who were praying every Sunday in the church, what happened to them? What happened to the God? He suddenly disappeared from Russia, was afraid of the Communist Party, was afraid of Stalin, that he will be shot. What happened to his all-pervading wisdom, compassion, love? Everything disappeared and these millions of people simply died, went on dying. So they have to invent miracles. They have to invent great fictions, stories, in which God does great things. He never does in front of you. Not a single eyewitness about anything. Just it is written in the books. Jesus raised Lazarus from his grave. Now a man who can raise a dead back to life is absolutely important on the cross. That was the time to show the miracle. He could have changed the cross into a crown. Into a golden throne. That would have been a miracle. But that time, he cannot do anything. And he prays to God. And up to now, he was doing miracles. Now he is asking God to do the miracle. And God is completely deaf. He shouts, "Have you forsaken me?" But there is no reply from the sky. Priests created God then to support a lie. They created other lies. And they went on creating for thousands of years. And people went on searching into these lies some way to find the truth. You will be lost in those theological lies. It is a jungle of lies. No, that is not the way for truth. The way for truth is just to avoid all theology. Christian, Hindu, Mohammedan, Jaina, Buddhist, avoid all theology. Avoid all that the priests have invented. Remain with your question and make it a quest and search within. It is better to ask, "Who am I?" rather than to ask, "Who created the world?" Even if you know what you are going to do. I say, "A created the world." Then what? You will ask, "Who created A?" The real religious question has nothing to do with God at all. The authentic question is, "Who am I?" And the only way to know is, be silent, be alert, be aware. Watch your thoughts and let them disappear. One day you will find all has become silent. Not even a murmur of thought. Everything has stopped as if time has stopped. and suddenly you are awake from a long, long dream, from a nightmare. And once you know your being, you know the whole of being, because your being is not an island. It is not separate from the whole. It is part of the whole continent, of the whole existence. And once you have known your part, you have tasted. And the taste all over the existence is the same. And the moment when one comes to know oneself, one knows that all religions have been businesses, business establishments founded by cunning people. You have been cheated. The moment you know yourself, you know such a blessing that in that blessing all doubts, all questions disappear. Have you observed a simple fact that when you are happy, you never ask why I am happy? But when you are miserable, you always ask, why I am miserable? When your head is healthy, you don't ask any question, why my head is not suffering from a headache? But when you have a headache, then certainly you ask, why this headache? I am trying to remind you that when you will be full of blessings inside, all your questions will disappear. Not answers, disappear. Dissolved, not solved. And being in that state of no questioning, no doubting, no belief, but utterly fulfilled, contented, knowing happens. One becomes a Solomon.
The word content and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. all rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.